Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, most on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the 10K Collective, the place for six, seven, eight-figure Amazon and e-commerce sellers. I'm speaking today of Kanak Ogra of Rural Handmade. So Kanak, you were just telling me where you are. I know you're originally from India and you've lived all over the globe. Where are you today?
So I actually now live in London, and this is home now for hopefully the next time we move.
Excellent. And where are you in London?
We live at Canary Wharf. The office is at Canary Wharf. So anyone who wants to come and say hi to us, just feel free.
Excellent. Good. Yeah, it's good to know where people are physically sometimes in the world. Now, I'm very happy to be part of London myself. It's a very, very global community, which I think is an excellent starting point for anyone who's selling online these days. So talking of global, we've been discussing Rural Handmade Goods and your very exciting business that connects rural handmakers to marketplaces and sellers, including those who sell on Amazon or other e-commerce channels. So let's get into the nitty-gritty of how people could actually make money. Let's talk through some of the details. So what can you do for retailers right now at Rural Handmade?
So for retailers and for businesses in general, what we have two solutions. Number one is the data-driven solution. And number two is the design solution. Now, a data-driven solution is basically what we do internally as a company. We have built few algorithms, some predictive analytic tools that helps us map and understand consumers' buying behavior. So what that basically essentially means is that we are in trend. We know exactly what people are buying. And this is across not just on Amazon, but on Alibaba and Etsy and various other websites that we keep, you know, we keep using them as to pivot on what's selling. Now, this information of data, actually we share with entrepreneurs and then help them understand what are the key areas they should probably focus on. And then they would eventually go back and come out with their own design idea, which we then commission into a low-cost make-to-order product with the help of these, you know, many, you know, hundreds of thousands of makers that we have based out of Southeast Asia, so India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh.
You got the data side as well. That's very, very interesting. So tell me a bit more about this data side. So we mentioned in the previous episode, so if you didn't catch it, folks, really, really worth catching. The data side, interesting. So you have what is essentially is like sort of Jungle Scout type thing, or what's the sort of nature of that compared to the standard Amazon research tools, for example, which is probably the most familiar things that people will be familiar with when they're listening.
Right. So Jungle Scout and Helium 10, all these different softwares obviously use a very simple process of actually web crawling, and then they kind of, you know, look at the BSR and different, you know, models that they've actually developed internally to understand what is selling, what is not selling, and then show it to you. What we have done is basically replicate the same model with our own internal algorithms for different websites. So it can be for Etsy, it can be for Alibaba, it can be for different websites. And the idea is to basically not just capture the Amazon's sales and how the product move on Amazon, but also look at different other e-commerce websites and portals. Because at the end of the day, we're trying to give the best and most informed knowledge bank to our entrepreneur partners. And we just don't want to rely on Amazon, but we want to actually rely on the global e-commerce market. And that's what we kind of stand. And so this is obviously, it still is in the niche phase, still is in the development phase. A lot of it, we've run a few trials and been doing pretty well. But we're happy to share whatever knowledge we have, as we pivot onto specific domains of what the entrepreneurs eventually wants to make.
That's great. I mean, it's good to have a tool that works in the slightly broader trend. Apart from anything else, just because something's not a trend on Amazon yet doesn't mean it isn't going to be. I mean, if Amazon represents, say, 50% of e-commerce in the USA, it could be that sooner or later, every trend is going to show on Amazon, or at least most of them. I suppose some things might only be on Etsy or something. But yeah, it's good to break away from the Amazon echo chamber, as Will Chernin calls it, because yeah, that gets a bit too narrow pretty quickly. Yeah, let's go back to the design side. So you're saying that you mentioned before that a seller could just sketch a design on the back of a napkin kind of thing and then give it to you. Then you'll make a clear design with drawings and what have you. And then you'll hand it on to Rural Handmakers based in Southeast Asia, and then the process starts. So let's look into the details of this. Let's say I want to make, for some reason you're saying a leather thing, I'm quite liking this idea, so let me roll with this. I want to make a leather kind of messenger wallet, which is designed for globetrotting entrepreneurs. I'm liking this already, actually. I might make this. So that if you heard it here first, folks, don't go and compete with me. And again, this is the paranoia Amazon sellers have, because they're used to something off Alibaba that's so easily replicated. So let's say I want to make a messenger thing. It's going to need to contain a laptop, maybe a notepad, maybe a phone charger, and a few cool things like that. What if I've just got the idea as raw as that? Can I come to you at this raw stage and say, have you got some guidance for me in how to make this differentiated, or the kind of exact leather bags that are on trend right now? Would you be able to go from something as general as that? Or do I need to come with a much more specific researched idea to you first?
So we can actually cater to both the audiences. If you have a specific need and a specific ask, we can absolutely do it for you. And also to entrepreneurs who have a broad idea of, you know, you want to do something in one specific, let's say leather, but you don't have a design idea. So we can give them recommendations in terms of, why don't you try this and try that? And if they like the idea, we commission the design into a product and show the sample. If everything's fine, we then, you know, produce it to whatever numbers they need. So another interesting thing is that, you know, I think a lot of Amazon entrepreneurs, you know, I keep meeting a lot of them, and the one thing I've seen is that they are very scared of the manufacturers or people from China actually, you know, hijacking the listing. And the thing that I have seen is that if you can actually get done through the handmade space, it becomes very, very difficult and literally impossible to copy your design. Because if somebody has to copy you, they will have to go to the same playing grounds as us. And it's a very tedious task to do. So it's a strong defensibility. At the same time, the raw materials that you use in the handmade industry is a very unique, very sustainable, very organic, and very natural raw materials. You know, it can be terracotta, it can be recycled metal. So there's basically no plastic, which means it's difficult to replicate it because some of these raw materials are difficult to find if you don't go into the in these remote areas where they actually are in abundance. So for example, hemp. If you want things to be made in hemp, then you probably have to go to let's say Nepal, where it is even legal to export hemp. And then you have to commission the design and do it. You couldn't do it in most part of the world. So this is where you are able to create a very defensible kind of a brand as far as the hijacking is concerned.
That's really, really great. And I really think this is absolutely critical because I was talking the other day to Kevin King for the show. And if you didn't catch that, folks, look out for that. Just go to 10kcollective.com. We've had a very sobering call with Kevin King about the black hat tactics that Chinese suppliers are using. Now, China's a big country, but actually the number of companies that you're looking at is probably 50 or 60 companies in the southern coastal region, but that employ tens of thousands of people. And they are the ones who are just basically just playing every trick in the book to try and dominate on Amazon. So trying to compete against those guys, even legitimately, is hard enough because they have the capacity to create, as you said, plastic widgets, particularly, or silicone in abundance. But also they are not playing by the rules. And probably not going to be. So anything that keeps us as far away from those kinds of products as possible is going to be safer and more defensible. So yeah, I couldn't agree more. And the idea that it's very, very hard and awkward to copy is fantastic news. So that's an extremely good point. Thank you for bringing that up, because it's probably, as you say, the number one thing that keeps us awake at night as Amazon sellers, apart from Amazon account suspension, is probably getting copied by or undercut by Chinese manufacturers.
Absolutely. There's one more thing I want to add, Michael, which is a very interesting thing. So right now, as we speak, and I know everybody understands Amazon is extremely difficult to, you know, you need to be ranked, you need to, you know, replenish. Now, if I give you two value propositions, which is you buy one SKU for 5,000, or you buy 7 to 10 SKUs for 5,000, you're literally, as you kind of launch, you're already hedging your risks. Because if you rely on one product and it does not work, you've lost all the money. But if you do your research and you launch 10 of them, you probably might see success in 3-2 of them, and others might not work. But now you could then, with the same amount of money, have learned a lot more. And now you can actually continue to continue with the success stories you've had and then keep reinventing the wheel of launching new products. So you have to now launch not just one, but little more than, you know, close to half a dozen, if you really want to be successful selling on Amazon, because it's a bit of, you know, a black box on success rates if you launch only one.
Completely agree with that. And I like the black box idea, which is another engineering concept, right? But it's, in other words, we're not sure what happens inside the mechanism. And really, the truth on Amazon, for all that, there are some very clever data scientists, you know, using algorithms to, like at Jungle Scout Helium 10 viral launch, to name but the best three that I know and the best known. But they are very clever at using minimal data to extract a lot of potential information. But it is, at the end, based on the BSR, which is very little data. So it's just not going to be 100% reliable. Plus, everyone else is seeing the same data. And again, talking about the Chinese, they all use Jungle Scout. So they're seeing the same data. So I agree that there's no substitute for experimentation, and that implies success and failure. So it's an extremely good point. It really is a very powerful point. To the point where I would say, if somebody's only got $5,000 in their back pocket, just because you could afford to launch one product, I don't think that means you're ready to launch an Amazon business these days. I think if you're looking at mass-produced products, then that is, it's just not enough. But talking of which, that brings me very neat to the question of MOQs. My perception is that with raw handmade stuff, MOQs are lower, which you're implying is true, and that capacity is more of an issue. So let's talk about MOQs first. So what are the sort of minimum order quantities that you can start with for raw handmade goods?
So obviously the handmade industry is a very tricky industry, especially because a lot of makers, they're basically not as educated as a lot of us are, and their vision is also very limited. Now, the way this works is, the first few iterations that they do is painful for them because they're used to just, you know, make things in a very quick manner. But once we have commissioned the design, now to replicate this product is actually a very easy job. Now, how many can we replicate? The answer lies in the number. So, you know, I can't emphasize this enough, the fact that this is the second largest employer. Only in Southeast Asia, you have about between 120 to 150 million people working directly and indirectly in this industry. Very skilled people can do, you know, 300, 500, 5,000 sometimes as well, you know, depending on, you know, how crucial and what kind of raw materials are needed to make this. So scalability is actually not a problem, and especially not a problem for Amazon sellers, because they don't order in hundreds of thousands of quantities. They probably do, you know, between 500 to 5,000, probably more, but in a smaller range. So scalability is definitely not an issue, and we've never had an issue of scalability. Rather, we've had an issue of not enough numbers. So people come and say, you know, 100 pieces and 50 pieces. That does not make a business case, because you eventually will be spending a lot on shipping. You won't benefit, the makers won't benefit, we won't benefit collectively. So I think anything between 300 probably seems like a good order to start with, and then we can, you know, move on and then scale up to whatever numbers you need.
Okay, so the MOQs need to make a certain amount of sense. So there's a sort of lower limit. I mean, so you say 300 units is a typical number. What sort of price? Let's take a specific example, because it's always easy. Let's say I'm making a leather bag. So it's about, depending on which, whether you like metric or imperial, I guess it's like, you know, about a yard or a meter wide and say, I don't know, 70 centimeters deep or something. It's a normal sort of messenger bag size, so fit across your chest kind of thing. It's made of leather. And of course, I'm sure there's like 10,000 different qualities of leather, which I don't know about. But let's say it's nice, like the equivalent of fine Italian leather, which is kind of quite a brand, but I don't know what the sort of Indian or Indonesian equivalent would be. You know, what sort of cost per unit might I be looking at? This is a very, how long is a piece of string question, I do realize, but I'm just trying to get some kind of flavor.
Right, no, absolutely. So this kind of a product would roughly cost you between, I would say, between a range of £3 to £6, which is obviously not a lot. And the big reason why we're not expensive is because of the disintermediation we have in the supply chain. We're not a typical Alibaba mediator who has connections with exporters and manufacturers. We literally work seamlessly with the maker community. So these are SMEs and micro enterprises. So we actually, to be honest with you, we have the best prices that anybody could offer in the handmade space to you. And so yeah, 3 to 6. And then again, it depends on if you want to order a small batch. So we're not like hell-bent on 300. We can start off by a smaller one as well. So for example, this one, we can start off by doing 100 as well, because it's between £3 to £6 per unit. Essentially, what I'm trying to say, it has to make a business case. If you're trying to sell on Amazon, if you're trying to ship it, a lot of these costs that are incurred in a normal supply chain. And you know, you can't expect to do a business by, you know, by 20 pieces and 30 pieces. If you want to do that, you're probably better off buying it locally in the wholesale market.
Absolutely. And there's no reason, by the way, that somebody can't start off by selling something wholesale from a maker. And if I'm particularly in a global city like London, you're quite likely to find there's probably some guy who sells raw handmade stuff from, I don't know, Morocco, for example. I think of leather goods. There's some beautiful stuff we came across with a business partner a while ago in Birmingham at the exhibition center there, and whatever I can't remember the name of the exhibition now, but he probably, you know, could do you some stuff in the UK where he'd add his markup to it. You could test the market for that with, you know, 10 pieces. And then once you want to scale up, you could come to something like you guys. But having said that, 100 units at £3 each or something, I mean, that's presumably manufacturing costs, but that's a really pretty cheap way of testing a market, in my opinion. So anyone who finds that a lot maybe needs a different business model. But tell me a little bit more about the other costs. How does the shipping work? Because obviously shipping out of China is a very, very tested, standardized thing from Shenzhen, Guangzhou, the usual Eastern ports. So let's say that I want to sell in the USA. I've got my warehouse. Let's say Amazon's been kind to me and given me one warehouse to send goods to you as opposed to three, which doesn't always happen. And let's say that warehouse is in California to make life easy. So how would you go about dealing with the supply chain? Is logistics something you help with, or do you just, how do you deal with the logistics side of things?
Oh, we could help you with logistics. It's not a problem. I mean, we have, you know, local transport partners, which basically essentially are people who have a truck. They help us, you know, move the product from this village or this remote area to a central warehousing, which we have in India, which manages in the entire Southeast Asia operation. From the central warehousing, we then drive all the way to the ports, depending on which part of the world you live in. You know, in Mumbai, which is this large port based out of, you know, western part of India, and then you can ship, upload the container. It can literally be, you know, 5 CBMs for 5 clients, and then it ships all the way to the US or to the UK or to Germany or to Japan. It doesn't really matter. And then we can help you even down there. I mean, I live in the UK, so we have a lot of you know, logistics partners which can help you then, you know, reach to Amazon FBA, or you have a different warehouse if you want to not pay long term storage fees or storage fees in general. So we've got all these partnerships in place, and it is not a big problem. I mean, logistics and shipping is actually, you know, I always often say that it's like a 2,000-year-old practice, and it's very lean. It's very well organized. Absolutely no problems.
Great. I mean, because that's one of the things that people talk about. I was speaking there. I did an interview just yesterday with somebody who's UK-based as well, a British UK-based guy, and they do a lot of shipping around. They said most stuff that they sell, help people sell rather, is based from China. And he said one of the reasons is because the logistics is just more organized in China than, for example, India. So your experience seems to say that actually it's not that disorganized. I mean, I don't know. I have no personal experience of shipping stuff in from India, so I can't from experience. Can you speak to that for a second to reassure people, or give us a reality check if it is difficult?
Oh, no, it is. It's very easy. I think it's definitely not complicated. I think what happens is, obviously, I think China has been able to, you know, show the world, you know, how consistently and repeatedly that the quality is there and their SOPs in place. And a lot of these countries, not just India, Indonesia, you know, the entire Southeast Asian belt is big into streamlining a lot of these, you know, processes and stuff. So I think it's definitely not a problem. We've not seen any problem. I think Amazon is just a very small bit of it. In general, there are a lot of things that you can actually, that already gets shipped across the Southeast Asian belt.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, as you say, these are not new industries. I know, for example, Pakistani steel industry supplies a great deal of Western hospitals with surgical steel and things like that. So it's not like those supply chains haven't been in place before. But it's interesting. I mean, and maybe the fact that you guys have proper partnerships with and connections and understand whatever the local culture may be, and that's just as true in China, is even more important. That in the end, it comes down to having somebody on the ground who's an expert and understands people and has the relationships, and then things flow smoothly. And it's totally possible to have a completely ugly experience importing from China if you get that wrong. I've done that a couple of times myself. So yeah, in the end, I guess it comes down to logistics is an expert specialist area, and outsource it to somebody who knows the stuff, and you won't have a problem. So sounds like you've got a handle on that, which is great. Tell me a bit more about the design side of things. We talked about some of the MOQs, the capacity, the sort of costs. You mentioned you could do a sketch on a piece of paper and then give it to somebody. How does that work in practice, and what are the sort of costs of that?
Absolutely. So that's a good point. So our design team actually is a very small team. We've got about 5 to 6 people. Their backgrounds are engineering, product development, and just general, accessory designers. So there are three kind of people we have, three set of minds we have, and that's it. Depending on how complex the project is, it goes, you know, in between the teams, and then they come out with, the best possible output. And we've tried to keep it a very simple team because I think we just need, few great minds to help and solve these complex problems. And our biggest value that we get is from the entrepreneurs who come out with the exact solutions that they've identified for the problem. And then to convert that into an image isn't necessarily the most complicated thing. But it's the first part, is that what you truly believe in, which is the same thing I often say. I think what makes Amazon great is not the consumers, it's actually the sellers who actually bring the right product for the consumers. And our story probably isn't very different. We really want right entrepreneurs to come up with the right set of problem-solving ability, and then we commission that into a low-cost make-to-order model. And so everybody wins. The makers get employment, you sell more products, and you become a better seller. So it's a win-win for literally everybody.
I think what you're implying is really that, coming back to the basic job, what is the you talk about disintermediation of the supply chain. We'll come back to that very buzzworthy word in a minute. But one of the things, I guess, I always think about the supply chain is, as Will Chernin puts it, if you're not adding value to the supply chain, sooner or later, you're going to be priced out of it. So I guess one of the things we can offer as Amazon sellers or you know, somebody who's going to be part of the supply chain is really understanding the customer's need. And I think that's actually the main thing that I could offer. I'm not an expert in making things. I'm not an expert in logistics. I'm not Amazon, so I'm not providing the marketplace where people can physically buy things. So what do I add? I think what I do is I take the trouble to really understand a particular type of consumer and the exact needs they have, and then look around at what else is on offer for them and see where the gaps are. Like, they really need a leather bag that is, you know, light and that they can take on a plane without a problem. I'm thinking about my leather bag, but for some reason I'm in love with this leather bag idea, but I have no idea. So, you know, but it may be I've experienced the fact that my laptop doesn't deeply fit in it or it falls out. So I want something that's very, very centered around a laptop, for example. And I understand it because I'm my own consumer. And then my mates often travel with their laptops to Amazon conferences and want to look cool. Then you're starting to have something to offer, right? I think in the end, if all we offer is a vague idea that we want to make some money, which a lot of people start off with, we're not adding value. And I love the fact that you've just said, look, the design isn't actually the hardest thing. It's sounds like you're saying understanding the consumer clearly is understanding is the hardest thing. Is that about right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's really good to be clear that our job is to go and understand the customer, really. And people skip over that quite quickly, actually. They want to look for the magic hacks. I mean, even more grown-up entrepreneurs who I think should know better are just very obsessed with Amazon algorithm hacks. I'm like, dude, what about understanding the consumer? Like, really, 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 really understanding the consumer. So that's really good. So let's move on to the question of pricing and positioning thing. You've already mentioned the positioning of rural handmade goods is that it's very sustainable, that you're helping people to develop better lives in rural communities, which is very powerful. What about price points? What sort of price points and profit margins could people make if they say, let's take our leather handmade bag for £3 cost or something, let's say £5 to be generous. If I'm selling it in the UK or US, what kind of price points might I be able to make for that?
Well, that's a really good point. I think the thing with handmade is, and what we've seen is, it's a really unexplored market. Now, a lot of these Louis Vuitton bags or Gucci bags, you know the prices they sell at, and a lot of them actually do manufacture them in the Southeast Asian countries and not in China. Now, they have been obviously able to put up a price point, which is obviously, you know, beyond most people's imagination. But I think it eventually boils down to what do you feel is the right price, looking at the competition? How well do you strategize your marketing opportunities around the product, right? And how well do you actually solve the consumer's problem? So Amazon, obviously, I know it's price sensitive. It's difficult to be in the first page. But having said that, this value proposition hasn't been tested as much. So we don't really know what the prices of, if it is handmade, could be or should be. So, but I still feel that you could probably start off by you know, getting traction and then move on to, you know, launching products that are at a premium price. I think that probably would be the right strategy. But pricing with handmade, you know, I live in London. I mean, I see some prices which I feel is, you know, how is it even possible? And so it's a very tricky question to ask me because I don't know the answer to it.
No, it's an honest answer. It was a kind of dumb question, but it's kind of, in the end, a question that you're going to have to figure out as a seller. I mean, the main thing is we want to know the income side as well as the cost side. But I guess you could flick it on its head and say, okay, you know what? It doesn't really matter if the selling price isn't what you expected, as long as you, A, keep the buying price very affordable, and B, minimize risk. So as you said, exactly what you said earlier, I think in the previous episode, which is if you've got $5,000 to spend or £5,000, you're so, so much better at spending a certain amount on 10 different SKUs and seeing which one takes off. And then actually the price point is less critical. Then you can start exploring, okay, which things will make the bigger price point. So I mention it just because it's always the question that everyone has at the top of their mind, how much money can I make from this? But I think it comes back down as well to one thing you said, which is really important, which is a very good positioning on Amazon is affordable premium, i.e. a high-end feeling product, but an affordable price. And you mentioned that sustainability is a bit of a luxury good at the moment and not very affordable for a lot of people. So if we can be the people that make sustainability affordable, I guess that's pretty solid positioning, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So tell me about this word, this buzzword, disintermediation is the supply chain. You better talk about it because I can't even say it. What does that mean and why is that important?
Absolutely. So disintermediation basically is a very simple concept in which what we're trying to do. So let's look at what does a big giant like John Lewis or Walmart would do if they have to make handmade things. So usually the way this works is that John Lewis would have somebody called as an internal buying agent whose responsibility is to just keep scouting for different ideas and products that will fit the John Lewis retail sector. Now, what they do is if they have a design or an idea, then they float this design and they look at different vendors across different countries. So let's say if there's a vendor or a buying agent based out of Nepal who says, you know what, we can do this in hemp exactly with the same dimensions, with the quality and SOPs and everything. Now, this buying agent then contacts local, you know, manufacturers. They're local manufacturers, exporters, a mix of everybody. Now, these different local manufacturers and exporters then eventually go to SMEs. They go to these micro enterprises, which are the people we work with directly. Because in the handler industry, the unique thing is that nobody employs people for some reason. They all work as contractors. So it's basically a massive gig economy that is just working in a very unorganized manner. Now, these people, these micro enterprises, then have these 20 people and 50 people and 100 people and 150 people who then make the product. And all these different exporters or manufacturers, what they do is they aggregate everything, do the quality control, and then send to the buying agent. And then the buying agent then ships it to the John Lewis buying agent or to the John Lewis warehouse. Now, this is a very normatic process. And what we are saying is that in 2019, when we know that these SMEs who employ 10 people, 20 people, as a mix of contractors and as employees, we could directly reach to them. So what happens is now, of all that 5% and 3% and 7% cut that everybody's taking, we pass it on to the entrepreneurs. And so they benefit massively. So if you actually work with us, there's just the entrepreneur, rural handmade, and then the makers, or the SMEs and the maker community. And this is what we classify as a complete disintermediation of the supply chain.
Excellent. So you got the entrepreneur, rural handmade, the artisan, and I guess in the end, the consumer. And I suppose you've also got Amazon, but yeah, you could go direct to consumer. So yeah, and it's interesting what you're saying to get a vision of how this stuff works. I mean, everybody, there's so many intermediaries. And I've got this vision in a way that across history and across the Silk Road, which is some of the sort of ancient ways that East and West trade has happened, is I guess there's always been a lot of people taking a cut out of everything, right? And it sounds like in a way it hasn't changed for a long, long time, like hundreds of years.
100%. And we think because of internet and mobile phones, we truly believe is that if you live in a remotest part, and the future is all about you live in the remotest of the regions, and then if you are a buyer based out of Salt Lake City, Utah, you could directly reach out to them through our technology, maybe. Maybe we'll come up with an app and then connect you directly. And then we will just do quality control and assurance and design ideas, suggestions, stuff like that. So yeah, I mean, it's basically a win-win. And I think future, for us, we truly believe future is local, future is handmade, and future is sustainable. I think I can't emphasize this enough. I think I do often talk about that we believe the fifth revolution, which is just very close, I think, after the fourth revolution of IoTs and driverless cars, it's going to be handmade. It's going to be creative space. So I think handmade is definitely a near future we're talking about.
Amazing. So, all right. So let's come back to one other question I've got around this, which is that Amazon, being a very smart company, probably employs people as smart as you, and they've actually created something called Amazon Handmade, which I didn't know existed until I was researching for this interview. And this came into existence because of Etsy, it seems, because obviously Etsy's taking a piece of the e-commerce pie, although a very modest piece in terms of percentage of revenue at the moment, which Amazon's looking at and thinking, we want some of that. So how do we compete with Amazon Handmade, which, as far as I understand, is trying to reach out to the same artisans that you're reaching out and trying to cut out the middleman as well?
Right. So absolutely. I think Amazon Handmade is brilliant. I think we as consumers, as Amazon Prime members, should actually actively seek out and figure out how do we actually buy handmade. Just as simple as that. If you're buying something, why not make an informed purchase? So in no way we're trying to compete with Amazon Handmade. I think it's a brilliant platform for makers across the world. What we're just saying is that Amazon Handmade is good for you if you live in the UK, in the US. But if you live in Mozambique, I don't think in the next 10 years we'll have a maker from Mozambique be able to sell seamlessly in the UK because of many issues, including supply chain. So what we're saying is that we are becoming an aggregators of these micro entrepreneurs or micro industry members, and then help them reach out to the Amazon fraternity, which is a different set of sellers as well as the community in general. So it's basically solving the same problem, but with the help of a different mindset.
Okay, interesting. So I guess what you're saying is that the Amazon Handmade, although they have a very clearly a picture of somebody who looks like they're in sort of rural India, at least to judge from their appearance and the sort of background they're in, maybe it was all photoshopped, but they're kind of giving the impression that it's about doing the same thing you guys do, but in practice, as you say, which makes sense, that it's not really practical for somebody in rural India at the moment to directly supply Amazon, but actually it needs aggregating together and the communication issues need solving, and you're the guys to do that. So that does make sense. I just thought it's worth checking out. I mean, it seems that Amazon is making a play into it. It's not really their natural territory, let's say that. I mean, is it? They're not Etsy. They don't have the mindset of Etsy. They are not geared to handmade. I mean, Amazon's natural playing spaces is those major offices they have over in the southern coastal region in China, I would say. So that's definitely an important cultural difference, I think, that we can actually exploit, that Amazon is basically looking at China whilst we're looking into rural Southeast Asia. The other area, of course, of people that we've got to consider is existing retailers and how to get ahead of those, because obviously you mentioned John Lewis, that's a strong retail brand. Gradually they are shifting to online, although a lot of them are doing a pretty horrible job of selling online, but some of them are doing better gradually. How do we compete with the traditional retailers as well?
Well, we generally do not want to compete with retailers. We actually want to partner with retailers, and we actually genuinely feel for them. I'll give you a simple, stats about the UK retail. The UK retail is about £350 billion, and unfortunately, every year, 14,000 retail shops go bust. They go out of business. And what we've seen is the mindset that the retailers have. I mean, if you look at how retailers procure products, they still have this very, very old school way of touch and feel, and they feel, yeah, this is probably going to sell because I saw it online, and then they stock the product, which basically is a massive cash flow problem because it's a possibility they might not sell because they're not using, the state of techniques and tools to actually procure things. On the other hand, the big problem retail has is that their supply chain is exactly the same as Amazon's supply chain, which is mass produced from China, and then they stock the product. Now, just the nature of retail, the way it works is you cannot compete with online Amazon marketplace because of the whole process of Amazon being in a virtual shop and you have a physical shop. There's an employment problem. There's obviously a problem for rentals and monthly electricity bills, etc. So what we're saying, is that the only way to fix this is if you can fix the supply chain and you find a reinventive supply chain where you can actually find products that are not necessarily on Amazon or something that have a USP or something where you have, as a wholesaler or as a retailer, provided this added value. And once you start rediscovering the supply chain, you then will see a change in your sales, change in the way you operate. And this is what we want retailers to start thinking and wholesalers to start thinking, that they can actually make a big value for the retail space that they have. 300 square feet, 500 square feet, 3,000 square feet, it's a beautiful retail space they have, which they are underutilizing at this stage.
Yeah, again, I guess what you're saying is they've got to add value in a way that other people aren't. So if Amazon's in the marketplace and they're working with the same Chinese factories that, say, John Lewis is, or John Lewis's brand, the people who sell to John Lewis are, then as well as the disintermediation thing, if you're not going to disintermediate, are you going to be part of the supply chain and add to the supply chain, add to the cost, therefore, to the consumer? You've got to add value. And I suppose one of the values you can have is that personal contact you can have in a store. I mean, talking of which, I guess in theory, we were talking earlier about really understanding the consumer. I guess in theory, if you work in a shop and you physically meet consumers, you should be able to really understand the consumers as well. I mean, do you think that that's a strength that traditional retailers have?
100%. And I think this is exactly what we think needs to be documented well. When customers walk into a store, they generally want to help the local small and medium-sized enterprises. I mean, when I walk to the store, my intention is to buy. The only problem is I do not find my product that I'm looking for. And this is where we think we can actually disrupt this whole retail business, in a sense that we can actually help them procure and store products that their customers are looking for. And once you're able to solve this problem, the retail is going to come back. It's going to bounce back in a way that you've probably not seen it right now.
Wow, so the savior of the British high street, that's going to be quite the, if you can pull that off, I mean, the next thing is probably going to be solving the Middle East crisis. I mean, that's going to be, impressive if you can do that. Okay, so that's great. So let's talk a little bit more about the final piece, which I think is that you were talking about the USP and the branding. So we talked about supply chain, we talked about some costs, we talked about traditional retailers. In the end, a lot of these things come down to differentiation, don't they? In order to maintain a healthy price and to keep your product selling as opposed to people just buying the other product that became $1 cheaper in the end. So tell us a little bit more about how you think the whole rural handmade thing is a USP or is part of your branding.
Well, I mean, so rural handmade, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is focus on the development outcomes. And this is, again, going a little bit broader, but our key focus is in sync with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, which are often called as the SDGs, which is basically 17 goals that they have outlined, which just talks about things like reducing poverty, gender equality, stuff like sustainability, equal opportunity, just very basic stuff. And rural handmade is basically deeply tied with these sustainable goals that United Nations has come up with. And this, if you look at these goals, this is exactly what we believe can help us transform the world we live in. So, selling the right products, giving opportunities to these makers, transfer of innovation from point A to point B will make this world a much better place to live in. And this is such a strong brand statement that I'm trying to make, but it generally is what we're doing as a company. The whole purpose of this company is to connect, is to educate, is to offer better prices, is to transform the way people buy and shop, for not just from the retail, but online and everywhere else. So, and then how do you go deep into it? I think it's obviously going to be a function of, specific domain that you work in a nutshell. So it's a massive, kind of a brand opportunity that we see as a company as well.
Amazing. Yeah, I warned everyone that they started listening that you're a very visionary chap, and that's absolutely true. I love the breadth of your vision, but it's also very, very practical, very, very businesslike. And I think when you combine vision and very businesslike, that's a serious entrepreneur. So, I think you're a very impressive guy. I really love this. So many things about this. How do people explore working with you and with Rural Handmade if they want to get in touch with you?
Absolutely. So, I mean, you can just go to the website online. If you go to ruralhandmade.com, we're obviously there on Instagram, we're there on Facebook. Do give us a like, do give us a follow back on Instagram, drop us a message on any of these platforms. You can also personally write to me. I'm more than happy to engage with you on a one-to-one basis, understand what your needs are. We are a growing company. And I think what we're trying to do is make this world a better place. And if Amazon entrepreneurs can actually, come out with problems that they think can solve their customer needs, that's like one step towards making this world a much better place. And at the same time, as we said, and we have the best prices, there's no reason why we collectively can't make sustainability more affordable for our consumers.
Amazing. Can't top that as a message. So thank you so, so much, Kanat, for coming on to the 10K Collective podcast.
Absolutely. Pleasure is all mine.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million US dollars or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, E for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.